William Shakespeare has been inspiring artists through the ages and around the globe. You'll find Shakespeare not just in theater, but in film, on canvas, in pointe shoes, and in just about any other art form you can think of. One of his most sparkling creations is the dueling couple who were meant for each other, Beatrice and Benedick, from Much Ado About Nothing. Clever wordplay and knife-sharp humor combine to make this unforgettable duo, who were meant to be the subplot, the standouts of the play. Charles II, in his copy of the Second Folio, even wrote Beatrice and Benedick next to the title of the play. He thought they were so important. Hector Berlioz is best known for his orchestral pieces, but in the 1850s he was commissioned to write a full opera. He chose to slip the confines of the problematic main plot line in Much Ado About Nothing and go straight to the comedy by centering his opera solely on the bantering pair, titling it Beatrice et Benedict. Having removed the upsetting complications and dark tones that emerge in the process of the relationship between main characters Hero and Claudio, Berlioz was free to concentrate on the more amusing secondary characters and keep the opera lighthearted and full of fun. It debuted on stage in 1862. Wichita State University commemorates the 400th anniversary of Shakespeare's death with a production of Beatrice et Benedict on October 13th to October 16th at Miller Concert Hall on the WSU campus. The music will be sung in French with spoken dialogue written by Shakespeare.
And as we welcome you to On Stage, I'm Fletcher Powell here, of course, with Sanda Moore Coleman. Hi, Sanda.
Hello, Fletcher.
And something I think is super interesting about this is what you say about Berlioz cutting out some of the major plot points of Much Ado About Nothing. Can you talk a little bit about why he would have done that?
The main characters, Hero and Claudio, are supposed to be the main couple, and we follow them through this, oh, they're in love, and it's sweet, and it's wonderful, and everything is happy. But the complications where Hero is set up to look as though she has cheated on Claudio. First of all, Claudio is really quick to believe these accusations that come from other people. He doesn't talk to her about it. So all of a sudden, in the middle of this comedy, or two-thirds of the way through this comedy, we're given this horrific scene where Claudio denounces his love at the wedding in front of everyone, humiliates her, and her father wishes she were dead. And she's this poor girl who's completely innocent, can only be forgiven in the context of the play by dying and by being proven innocent. And she does both. I mean, they think she's dead. They fool them. But
being a comedy, she's not dead, because
right.
Otherwise it would be a tragedy.
Otherwise it would be a tragedy, exactly. So, it's a bit jarring to have this horrific scene in the middle of a comedy. So it doesn't surprise me that he cut that out. But in adaptations and pieces of work that are inspired by Shakespeare and other forms, other art forms, they seem to be a little less precious about it. They're a little more willing to experiment, to do different things.
And we've talked a little bit about that before when we talked about Shakespeare, is people are able to adapt it for their own uses, able to either cut parts out or to, say, set something in a different time period, maybe to give us a little bit of a different perspective on all of that.
Right, right. Well, because Shakespeare speaks to the heart of what it means to be human, the work lends itself to adaptation and to inspiration for other art forms.
I wonder, You're talking about Much Ado About Nothing here. The most recent adaptation I know of is Joss Whedon's movie of Much Ado About Nothing. Did you see that?
I did see it. Amy Acker was fantastic. I just loved her.
Yeah, the movie I thought was really fun. And also before it came out, everyone was so excited because here's Joss Whedon, the master of dialogue, directing Shakespeare, a master of dialogue. But what I thought was the most interesting were the non-dialogue touches that Joss Whedon put in. There are little touches, say, where one of the characters is hiding behind the scenes and crawling around, and it's just hilarious, and he doesn't say a single word. It was just fun for me to see this kind of adaptation taken on by somebody with the kind of sensibility as Joss Whedon.
Yes, the gulling scenes. Mm-hmm. Those are always my favorite in whatever production it is. They're the funniest in the play. The thing is, interpretation doesn't happen in a vacuum.
Right.
You know, a close reading allows you to ground ideas and concepts in the text. And as long as you can take your concept and carry it through to the end of the production, then it's a success. It goes from being an idea to being a concept. But if you have an idea and you think, oh, that would be cool, and then you drop it halfway through, you don't extend it, then it's no longer a concept, it's a gimmick. And then that kind of works against you.
So it is a fine line to walk.
It is. Movie adaptations and movies that are inspired by Shakespeare to me are fascinating. I mean, Kurosawa's Throne of Blood, absolutely the scariest interpretation of Macbeth that I have ever seen.
And he also, more than one Shakespeare adaptation, Ron, his adaptation of King Lear.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, there are those that are faithful to the text. Mm-hmm. And then there are modern interpretations. 10 Things I Hate About You was very popular, 20 years ago? but, you know, it was a modern retelling of The Taming of the Shrew, which is a difficult show to produce nowadays, as so many of them are. The Merchant of Venice, I saw a production of The Merchant of Venice, which is very problematic to produce these days. In 2011, it was at the Royal Shakespeare Company Theater, which was brand new at the time. And what was interesting about it to me was that they set it in Las Vegas, which was sort of the moral equivalent of Venice at the time. And the casket scene where Portia presents her suitors with the choice of three caskets. And if they choose the proper one, they get to marry her. It becomes a game show called Destiny. And it was wonderful. And Patrick Stewart played Shylock as a multimillionaire who was reduced to practicing his golf putting in his office, presumably because the golf clubs wouldn't allow him in. So it was an interesting production and shocking. Mm-hmm. And that's what theater should do. It should rock the ground, which brings me to a show that I just recently saw. A Midsummer Night's Dream is the newest production out of the Royal Shakespeare Company. Emma Rice was the artistic director, and she sort of created this pinata of Bollywood. it breaks open in this riot of color. And the juxtaposition, you know, there's always been this juxtaposition in A Midsummer Night's Dream between the waking world, the real world, and the dream world, the contemporary and the ancient. So what she does with this, the fairies, which are typically, you know, when we've seen productions of this show, the fairies are typically very airy.
Sure.
and waifish. And what she's done is made them ancient and wild. They're kind of gritty and dirty looking.
Ah.
And yes, and Puck is this bawdy, you know, randy kind of character who's funny but not cutesy. There's an edge to this Puck, a kind of a menacing.
That's interesting because at least spiritually, that's how I've always felt about Puck, even though that's not always how he's portrayed. That's always how he's felt to me.
Yes, he is an agent of chaos, mm-hmm. or she is in this case, an agent of chaos. And because in this society, we often associate mischief with cute, I think that that has sort of altered mm-hmm. some interpretations. But in this show, it's not like that. It's fantastic. I mean, you know that something wonderful is happening when you see on the stage there's this red neon sign that says "Rock the Ground," which is, of course, from speech Oberon makes to Titania, and "Rock the Ground whereon the sleepers be." These sleepers be. You know, she added so many contemporary tones to it that I found it very exciting. Not all of it was successful. But I mean, what a melange of influences she brought in. There was Beyonce, there was David Bowie. She took Sonnet 116 and set it to music. It was fantastic. It was just this swirling madness of color and conflict. And I just thought it was fantastic.
So this makes me think of two people who I feel have done similar things with Shakespeare, and both, I think, in very successful ways, though not always successfully, as you said. Not everything works, especially when you're throwing this much at it. But the two people I'm thinking of are Baz Luhrmann with Romeo and Juliet, mm-hmm. Which is difficult, honestly, to get into for me for about the first 20 minutes, and then after that, it's just beautiful. Mm. And the other one's Julie Taymor,
I love her.
Yeah, who's done a number of Shakespeare adaptations, and in such a way that it reminds me almost of watching animation, in that almost anything you can think of can happen. And that's what's exciting to me when somebody like Julie Taymor gets a hold of Shakespeare, is there's no limit to what you might see. The
exactly.
story continues basically along the same lines, although sometimes she make some alterations. But what you are going to see, you can't predict, and
right.
often you can't imagine before you've actually seen it. And that's what's so exciting.
And it's spectacular. And after you've seen it, you say, of course, mm-hmm. which I think is fabulous. I mean, how often does that happen? And then there's hip-hop Shakespeare.
Uh-huh.
Michael Kelly, for years in Toronto, has taught workshops where he teaches Shakespeare to students by using the iambic verse of Shakespeare set to hip-hop beats, and it's very successful. So he's not changing the text, you know, purists can relax. He's not changing the text. He's bringing relevancy to it in the same way that Hamilton brought relevancy mm-hmm. and to our political history, you know, and made that a living document. You know, most kids, when you ask them, they say, oh, I hate Shakespeare. And it's because they're reading it, in a classroom, in a textbook covered in footnotes and glosses, instead of witnessing it being performed on stage the way it's meant to be seen and understood by actors who know what they're saying and know what they're doing.
Yeah, nobody was sitting around in Elizabethan times reading Shakespeare thinking, oh, wow, this is great.
Right. No, they were with the groundlings and having a good time. in the Emma Rice production of A Midsummer Night's Dream at the Globe, one of the changes that she made, which caused the most furor, but lent an extra tenderness to it, to me, she changed Helena, the character Helena, to the character Helenus. So his Helenus is in love with Demetrius, who thinks he should marry Hermia to, you know, make his way in society. So the conflict there is not this cruel, you know, oh, get away from me, you horrible woman.
Mm-hmm.
It's, I can't love you.
Right.
It's not acceptable in our society.
That's fascinating.
So when they do come together, there is an extra tenderness to all of that, you know, to all of his speeches to Helena, who is now Helenus. There's an added poignancy to them instead of it being just sort of cruel.
Mm-hmm. And again, yet another way you can turn Shakespeare to reflect modern issues.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's what's beautiful about Shakespeare.
Here's a question I have, and I think I know what your answer will be, but I think it's fair to say most adaptations now like to take Shakespeare and stick them in another time period. That seems to be the default now. Do you think that it's starting to lose its luster because that's what's happening almost every time now? And do you think that there's still a place for simply putting it in the time period in which the play takes place and just letting it be what it originally was?
Well, I mean, I think that there are traditional interpretations of Shakespeare, and we have those recorded. So if you want to see an incredible performance of a traditional interpretation of Shakespeare, you should definitely check out Playing Shakespeare, the tapes made by the Royal Shakespeare Company with Trevor Nunn and John Barton, in which they demonstrate how the Royal Shakespeare Company approaches a text. And it's a really wonderful series. I will never forget seeing David Suchet and Patrick Stewart do dueling Shylocks. They were each individual interpretations, and that was interesting to me. I think there's a place for a traditional interpretation, but I think that we already know that story. I think that just changing the location is not enough. I think you have to have a reason for what you do. Like I said, interpretation is not created in a vacuum. If a concept, if a metaphor suggests itself from the material, which it does, because that's how great Shakespeare is, that's why we're still doing Shakespeare after all this time, it's your job as a director to fine-tune that and to ensure that it's a valid reading. It's got to be in the text. And, you know, within the text, you can interpret all kinds of things. You have to be able to back up your interpretation, I guess is what I'm saying. For it to work, it has to make sense within the context of the dialogue. But I don't think it's enough just to say, oh, well, we're going to make this a Wild West show. Mm-hmm. I mean, there has to be something in the text that suggests that would extend to that circumstance. But I am all for experimentation. I think that Shakespeare wrote beautiful work. He wrote work that still speaks to us after all this time because he dealt with basic human emotions. And you can fill in the details with whatever you like. I'm not a purist. There are people who think you should not alter anything. I think Shakespeare would have laughed at that. And I think also that when you take that approach, you're making it a museum piece, and then you put it on a shelf, put it behind glass, and it's dead. And that's not what I want for Shakespeare. I want a living Shakespeare.
Well, that's just about the best place I can think of to wrap this up. Sanda, thank you so much for being here, as always.
Woohoo!
And for KMUW, I'm Fletcher Powell.